This Torah class is brought to you by TorahAnytime.com.
Okay, good evening. Welcome to tonight's shiur. So the title of the shiur is Prison Exchange and the Maharam in Rothenburg. I just want to begin with a couple of words of introduction. Number one, of course, we chose a topic of the contemporary halacha shiur, and the sad inyan of the yom is, of course, the release of hostages and things like that. I was misupik. I was unsure whether this is an appropriate topic to talk about, but we discussed it last week, and I think but we discussed it last week, and I just felt that if dealt with sensitively and with respect, I think it's an appropriate thing to talk about. And really, it's a form of tefillah that Mitzvah Hashem, all the hostages should be released swiftly and safely, and we should have Basuras Tovas. Mr. Shem, it's a two-part shiur, so tonight we'll talk about the backgrounds and prison exchange in sort of halacha, with a focus on the Maharam in Rothenburg, and then next week we'll talk about what's happened since then. This is the medieval times, more recent times, the 20th century, the 21st century, the 1970s, hijackings and Gilad Shalit and all that sort of thing. That we'll discuss that, Mr. Shem, next week, but please God, again, like I say, we'll deal with it hopefully sensitively, and like I said, it's a form of tefillah. So let's begin. The background is a Gemara in Gittin. We'll come to the Maharam in Rothenburg soon, but let's just go through the background. The background, because sadly this is not a new occurrence, the concept of enemies attacking the Jewish people and taking hostages is sadly not new, and it goes back to a Mishnah. It's a Mishnah in Gittin on Daf Mem Hei Omad Aleph. So if you look at the top box on your handout, and again, if you're listening online, please email me at j.golker@gmail.com. I'll send you the handout. The Gemara in Gittin, Daf Mem Hei Omad Aleph, says, "Ein paidin es hashavuyin yose al kadei demehen." You're not allowed to redeem captives for more than their value. Now, that is a general term. We're talking about days when people had a value on a slave market. But of course, nowadays, the explanation of this is for an exorbitant sum, whether that means monetarily, that people ask for a huge amount of money, or something in exchange, whether that means other terrorists or who are being released or whoever it may be, or some form of concession. So anything which is considered unreasonable, which of course it almost always is, then the Chazal made a takana, a decree, not to redeem captives for anything which is considered unreasonable, an exorbitant sum of money or the like. Now, why do they make this decree? So the Mishnah says, "Mepnei tikkun ha'olam," which generally is understood to mean for the public good, for the betterment of society. Now, what is the rationale of that? Why did Chazal make that decree? So the Gemara itself discusses it. Diboy Elohu, the next line, "Hai mepnei tikkun ha'olam," what was the rationale for it? Either it could be mishum duchka de tzibura, which means it will cause a financial pressure on the community, that if, for example, a person is kidnapped and a ransom of £10 million is put on their release, that will cause a stress on the community. And certainly in days gone by, where there is not the affluence that there may be today, that could cripple a community. And certainly if it was repeated, then it would be very difficult, because there are limited resources in the community, and that could have a major effect on the community. So that's one svara why Chazal made this rule. A second reason is Dilma Mishum de lo ligrivu velai sutfei, which means it will motivate the terrorists to kidnap more people, because they'll see that they're earning money out of this, and if ransoms are paid, that will incentivize them to continue this practice. So those are the two reasons. Now, whenever you have two reasons, you've got to understand there must be enough kamina. There must be, why did they come on to a second reason? They're two separate reasons. There could be a difference between the two. And of course there is. The difference, the nafkamina between the two is, what if a family has private wealth? So for example, if a member of a family was kidnapped, the family get together and with their own financial means want to redeem that family member. So if the reason is because of duchka de tzipura, that's not a concern, because they're not turning to the community to raise these funds. But if the reason is the leligruvu v'laisu tfei, that it might incentivize them, then it is a concern, because they start with here and they'll move on to the next person. So that would be a nafkamin. And the Gemara brings an example. The Gemara says, the Levi, if you look at the last line on the first box, the Levi bardarga parkula barte, but Tesa Alfi Dinarizov, he redeemed his daughter for 12,000 gold coins. And therefore that would seem to suggest that it would be allowed if the family had financial means, and therefore the reason must be because of Duchka de Tzibura. That's why this person went ahead and did it. So the Gemara rejects that reason and says, no, Amar Abaya, who says? Man leimelon de berotzen chachamovit. Who says he did this with the consent of the chachamim? Maybe he just acted unilaterally without asking a shayla. And Dilma shelo berotzen chachamovit, says the Gemara. And the Gemara leaves it unresolved. And therefore, it's sort of, you know, the two reasons sort of, you'll see both reasons in Chazal, in Rishonim, in Achronim, in Poskim, down the generations, because both reasons seem to be applicable. Now, importantly, there in the Gemara in Gittin, in two places, Tosfos raised some very interesting points and some exceptions to the rule. Because Taisus on there on Gittin Mataf Memhei, this is box number 2, the first box in paragraph 2, Taisus asks a question. Taisus say that the Gemara in Ksuba says, Nishbis v'hoyim avakshim men adasar b'tameh apam rishon poideh, that they allowed a person to redeem a captive again for an exorbitant amount. So doesn't that violate the Mishnah? The Mishnah says, Ein poideh nisashruin yos al kadeh demehen. How come? Therefore, the Gemara in Ksuba tells of a case where this was done. So the Gemara gives the following, a few answers, the Tosfos, I mean, give the following answers. The first answer is, Shani Ishtai, which means a wife is different. To have you kagufo, she's treated like a person himself. And just like a person himself, Chazal never made that decree against the person. A person himself is kidnapped, then he will do everything he possibly can to redeem himself. So a person's wife is in the same category. He'll do whatever he can to redeem his wife. And therefore, that was never included in the takana in the first place. So the first exception to the rule is ishtai stroke gufay, a person himself or his wife, his spouse, that would be an exception and you would be allowed to redeem them. A second answer that Tosfos gives in the next line, Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya de parke lahu tinrik b'momen harbe, Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya redeemed a young child b'momen harbe for a huge amount of money. Bahani Zokin recorded in the Gemara there in Gittin, Daf Nun Ches Amud Aleph, Lefisha Hoya Muflog B'Chochma. A second exception. Someone who is Muflog B'Chochma, which means he's an outstanding Talmud Chacham. And you see from this Gemara, not only is the outstanding Talmud Chacham, but someone who has the potential to be an outstanding Talmud Chacham. So that person would be accepted, would be excluded from the Takon of Ein Poedin Es Hashruin. In other words, if he is so needed by the Jewish people because he is one of the leading figures in the Jewish world, that would be an exception. Or indeed, if he has the potential to be that. Now, that's the second exception. A third exception is, Tosfos says, Inami b'shas churban habayis lo shayich t'lo ligruvu. The reason of that you might motivate terrorists to kidnap more people is not relevant in the time of the Churban HaBayis, because in the time of the Churban HaBayis, they were doing it anyway. That's just what they did. They kidnapped. And therefore, they're out to get us. They're doing it anyway. So paying a ransom is not going to encourage them more or less. They will be carrying on doing this practice anyway. So it will have no impact on motivating more because they're just doing it. And therefore, that would be a third exception. And then a fourth exception, which is a Tosfos in Gittin and Ches Amud Aleph, in the next box in paragraph 2, Ki ikka sakonis nefoshes poedin shvuin yosach kadeh demein. Tosfos brings another example of when there is sakonis nefoshes, which means that the hostages themselves are in, their life is in danger. Now you may be thinking, because we're so preoccupied with the whole situation now in Eretz Yisrael, you might be thinking, well, surely every hostage situation is sakonis nefoshes. Surely, you know, it's so precarious that their life will be in danger in that situation. The answer seemingly is no. You know, sometimes the kidnappers are there, they're motivated by money, and they want to keep this person alive in order that they can get their ransom. So it depends very much on the situation. But clearly there are situations of sakonis nefoshes. Now, whether or not we pass like this, we'll see Mr. Shem next week. But just to summarize where we're up to, we've got the takana in the Mishnah in Gittin, Ein Poydin Es HaShvui in Yosim El Kdei Demehen. You're not allowed to redeem captives for an exorbitant and unreasonable sum or situation because of Tikkun HaOlam. Two reasons for Tikkun HaOlam. Number one, because it will put too much financial pressure on the community. Number two, it will motivate them to kidnap further. The nafkamina would be if a person can redeem an own family member. A person is not, we're not turning to the communal pot, as it were. That would be a nafkamina. And the Gemara leaves it unresolved. Tosfos introduces four exceptions to the rule. The first is Gufay or Ishtay. The second one is Talmud Chacham Muflug, an outstanding Talmud Chacham, and then or potential to be one. The third one is during the Churban, because they're doing it anyway. It's not going to increase it's not going to motivate them further. And the fourth and final one is captives are in mortal danger, Sakonis Nefoshis. Now, this brings us to the Maharam Rotenberg, because let me just give you the background to that case. The Maharam Rotenberg lived in the 13th century. He was born in 1220, and he was one of the last of the Baalei Tosfos. Rashi lived in the 11th century, 1040 to 1105, and his grandchildren were the first, well, his sons-in-law and his grandchildren were the first of the Baalei Tosfos, who were very prominent Rishonim and feature on every page of the Gemara Kimat. And there were many. There were dozens, if not hundreds, of Baalei Tosfos. Even here on England's shores, there's a Tosfos Chachmei Anglia, the Tosfos from England, and across Europe, mostly France and Germany. So he was born in France in 1220, and he was one of the last of the Baalei Tosfos. He learnt in the great French yeshivas. He was a Talmud of Rabbi Chiel of Paris. He witnessed the burning of 24 wagons of Gemara in 1244, after his Rebbe Rabbi Chiel was forced to defend the Jewish people in a disputation. And there is a kinnah that we say on Tisha B'Av, Shali Sarufa, which is about this very incident. So he witnessed that incident, and 24 wagons of Gemara which are burnt. Nowadays, every mitzvah boy pretty much gets a shas at some point. If not at the mitzvah, then, by the chasna he'll have one. But nowadays, Baruch Hashem, everyone's got a nice library. But in 1244, this is 300 years before the printing press became popular. So everything was written down, not just a Sefer Torah. So if you've got to write the Gemara out and you hand write it like on a cloth, it would take an awful long time to do that. And, destroying 24 wagon loads of Talmud destroys yeshivas throughout Europe. So it closed Torah learning down to a large degree. So that was the calamity. That was the travesty there. Now, he was the Rosh Hashiva, and he was the leader of Ashkenaz during the 13th century. He was a prolific writer. He wrote, we have still today, over about 1,000 tshuvas, which means people wrote to him, great poskim. Where do the big rabbonim, communal rabbonim, dayonim, where do they go to when they've got shilas? So they go to the leading poskim of the day. I've got a lovely photo in my office at home, maybe you've got it as well, of Dayan Aaron Tro Zatzal sitting with Rabbi Yashiv. And when, he was sort of here in the UK, certainly in Europe, he was the rabbi's rabbi. The Rabbonim and Dayanim would go to him to discuss things. And when he was uncertain, where did he go? So he goes to the premier poskim of this generation. He was very close to Rabbi Zalman, Rabbi Yashiv, etc. And there's a lovely photo of him discussing various matters with Rabbi Yashiv. So if you've got, you write to the leaders, the leading poskim of the generation, they're the poskim, they're the ones who write shilas and tshuvas. So the Maharam in Rotenberg was prolific, and we have still today over thousands of his tshuvas. Now, life in the 13th century was pretty horrific for Jewish people. It was very, very difficult. There was taxation which was targeted at Jewish people. There were pogroms, there were blood libels, there were very harsh decrees. And this spurred many Jews to try and leave Europe. They tried to go to Eretz Yisrael. Going to Eretz Yisrael in the 13th century was a very far cry to going to Eretz Yisrael in the 21st century. A few weeks ago, I had the zechus to be in Eretz Yisrael, and I daven shachris in London, mincha at the airport, and maariv, you can daven at the kosel. Now, if I would tell that to my great-grandfather, who was still, lived to the most of the 20th century, that I can, daven shachris in London, and a few hours later, daven maariv at the kosel, they think they wouldn't believe it. Yeah, my grandmother first came to Eretz Yisrael when my aunt got married in 1949, the first person to get married in Kibbutz Lavi, with Wellington boots under her wedding dress. And it took them, I think either 2 weeks to go by plane. Now, that was a chiddush to go by plane. And they had to make 5 or 6 stops. And some people went by boat, which took many weeks. And, you know, this is not... So going to Eretz Yisrael in the 13th century was very difficult. Moreover, the emperor, his name was Rudolf I, he declared Jews to be his personal property and he forbade them to leave Germany. But life was intolerable there. And the Maharam in Rottenburg set out for Eretz Yisrael with his family in 1286. He was spotted by a meshumad, by an apostate, in a place called Lombardy in Italy. And he was arrested and he was imprisoned in Germany in a castle called Eisenstein. And he was there for many years. And he refused, they put a figure on his head, 23,000 talents of silver, a huge, an exorbitant amount. But the Maharam refused to be redeemed. He refused to be ransomed because he was concerned that it might encourage more kidnappings. Now, his main Talmud was the Rosh. The Rosh is one of the three great Rishonim upon which the Shulchan Aruch bases his Shulchan Aruch. And the Rosh disagreed. Now, he disagreed with his Rebbe, as it were, because of this Tosfos. Because the Rosh said, well, what about Talmud Chacham Muflug? If you're a Talmud Chacham Muflug, you're one of the leading Rabbonim in the Jewish world, that is an exception to the rule. But we'll see in the Yom Shel Shlomo, we'll have to do it quickly, but he was insistent, and not only was he insistent, that the Maharam in Rottenburg died in jail, and he even refused that his body be allowed to be ransomed. And his body stayed in that castle for 14 years after he died. And only then, many years later, 14 years later, a very heavy ransom was paid by someone called Alexander Wimpfen of Frankfurt to redeem the body of the Maharam. And his only request was that he be buried next to him. Now, it's interesting, you go to Europe today and you see, you know, you go to the Warsaw Cemetery of hundreds of thousands of kvarim. 250,000 kvarim plus another 100 or 200,000 of unidentified kvarim. And it goes back a long way, and you can go back many hundreds of years. But going back to the Baalei Tosfos, there are not many Baalei Tosfos kvarim that you can see today, but you can see the Maharam in Rottenburg. And I've got a picture here that you can see the two kvarim. That's the Maharam in Rottenburg, and the Alexander Wimpfen is buried next to him. And you can still see this today. So it's a fascinating story. It's a very sad story. But it's a fascinating story. The question is, why did Maharam in Rottenburg not allow himself to be redeemed? And that is the subject of the Yom Shel Shlomo. Let's quickly look at it. It's the bottom box on the first page. The Yom Shel Shlomo says, Shamaiti. I'm going to the next paragraph, the second paragraph of the final box. Shamaiti al Maharam in Rottenburg, Zruchon Levrocha, Shayatofus Bemigdal Eisenheim. He was incarcerated for many years. And he wanted a huge ransom. We know it was 20,000 talents of silver. The community was willing to redeem him. And they didn't allow it. Because he said, because this violates the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, that's how we started this evening. Next paragraph, I'm perplexed. Says the Yom Shel Shlomo, the Marshal, writing 300 years later after this, in the 16th century. I'm perplexed. He was a Talmud Chacham Muflug, an outstanding leader of the Jewish people. There was no one like him on a par with him in Torah and in piety. You can pay whatever you want to redeem him. And maybe it was his humility that prevented him from giving permission to be redeemed. He should have been chayshish, says the Yom Shel Shlomo, on bittul Torah, not only his own learning, but the learning of others who need him to ask questions. Etc. So next paragraph, says the Yom Shel Shlomo, he's clearly, his intent was, she'im yiftu oisai, im kein yesh lemeches shemiyasu kol asorim letalmud chacham mufluk shebadar. That there his concern was that there was a real concern of a slippery slope that others will be kidnapped in his stead. And Bavur Rav Hamoman, and there won't be means to do that. And then he looked at the last paragraph, Kigam Shamaita Shoy Badas Osa Hatsoira Litfa's Gamarosh Tamidai. And I'll prove it to you, because the intention was that they would kidnap the Rosh when the Maharam died, they wanted to take the Rosh. Ubarach le tulitila. And the Rosh had to escape. And that's exactly what happened. The Rav was one of the great Ashkenazi Rishonim. And he escaped to Spain. And he was sort of found refuge there. He stayed in the Rashba's house, another one of the great Rishonim, for a week. The Rosh and the Rashba, these are giants of Jewish history. And he became a Rav in Sfaradi, Spain. So it was sort of east meets west. It was two different worlds. But the reason why the Rosh fled from Germany was because of this. His life was in mortal danger. And therefore, says the Yamsha Shlomo, it must be that the Maharam Mirotamag whilst, you know, the theory is that Talmud Chacham Muflug is one of the exceptions like we've seen. But he felt that it was too dangerous and it would cause, that it would motivate the enemies to attack and to kidnap outstanding Talmudei Chachamim. So that is part one. Miss Hashem, part two, what we're going to discuss is what the Halacha Lamaisa is today, what the Shulchan Aruch says, what the Rambam says, and in the Halacha today, what is the policy, if you like, in the Israeli army, and these are very difficult topics to discuss, but Miss Hashem will explore that a little bit more next week. But again, in the hope that Miss Hashem, the learning should be like a silent tefillah HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that we should have Besuros Tovos from Eretz Yisrael.
You've just experienced another Torah class brought to you by TorahAnytime.com.